welcome to another edition of the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. I'm delighted today to be joined by Philip Ingram from Grey Hair Media and Scott Wellesley, Head of Intelligence at My Intelligence Services. And we're going to have a little chat around nation state, state interference, the up and coming election, and whatever really takes our fancy around the threat from overseas. Welcome, Phil and Scott.
Good to be here, Mike.
Yes, thank you.
Might be good for our listeners who aren't familiar with you guys just to give them a quick 30-second potted bio of yourselves. Do you want to start, Phil?
Yeah, well, at the moment, I am a global commentator on geopolitics, defence, you know, what's going on in Ukraine and elsewhere for a lot of the major press outlets. I've got a regular slot on Talk TV, or Talk as it's called now, and regular slots on Sky Middle East and elsewhere. Beforehand, I was in the military for 26 years, most of my career in intelligence, left as a senior officer, but I also spent a lot of time as a military planner. So, you know, planning military operations at different levels, especially the higher levels, is a speciality. And then spent a bit of time in business before setting up my own media company, which allows me to get into all of these commentary situations.
Thanks, Phil. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, hi everybody. So Scott Wellesley, I'm Head of Intelligence at Mighty Intelligence Services. Like Phil, I have a former military background with 16 years, and I now head up the Intelligence Hub at Mighty, which is a 24/7, 365-day open source intelligence cell that works alongside Esoteric, which is a technical counter-surveillance measures service, and also the risk management service of Mighty as well. And our another sister department, Lynx and Perpetuity Arc. So looking at those wider boutique intelligence services is where I'm situated. I've been with Mighty for 7 years now.
Thanks, Scott. So let's start with Russia. Why not? Let's start with Russia.
are they up to anything in the world at the moment?
The story recently, the head of GCHQ warned that Russia was preparing both cyber and physical attacks against the West. And then more recently, from the Joint Parliamentary Security Committee chair, a warning to government that with the up-and-coming UK election, we face interference from Russia, but also China and North Korea. So that's an interesting trilogy to think about as well. But let's start with Russia and the story that they're potentially plotting both physical and cyber attacks against the UK.
Do you want me to start?
Who'd like to get us rolling on that one?
I can if you want, because Russia's not just starting to plan this. Russia's been executing cyber and physical attacks against the UK and against the West for many, many years. In fact, since the end of the Cold War. And you know, they were doing it during the Cold War. How do we know this? Well, we've got Alexander Litvinenko poisoned with polonium-210 on the streets of London. The use of a very nasty radiological device, that substance can only be manufactured inside nuclear reactors. You can fingerprint it. We've got the use of Novichok on the streets of Salisbury by the GRU, the Russians' first directorate, the military intelligence organization, to try and assassinate Sergei Skripal, and the wider implications of that. The more we scrape away at the veneer of different activities that have happened, the more we find there have been assassinations, assassination attempts, arson. There have been issues in the press recently about Russian-backed arson against Ukrainian-owned businesses in the UK and elsewhere. And of course, the cyber environment is constantly under attack. Those attacks are coming from advanced persistent threats, APTs. A lot of them are civilian criminal organizations and criminal gangs, but they operate out of Russia. Why do they operate out of Russia? Because Russia will turn a blind eye to their illegal activities, provided they pay a little bit of tax to the relevant oligarch that's looking after them. That oligarch is part of the state machinery. And part of that tax is not just money, but it's also carrying out activities on behalf of the state. And then the Russian state has got very capable cyber capabilities in a number of its different intelligence agencies that are attacking and probing into the West all of the time. So this warning coming out is suggesting that there are indications that that is going to get worse. And of course, we're in a year of elections, 60 elections across the globe, trying to influence those elections by creating greater unrest or instability in different places is a Russian speciality. So it doesn't surprise me at all that these warnings have been put out.
Undermining democracy wherever it might be.
Very much so. Not just in the physical domain, the cyber domain, but more often in the information domain as well. We have to ask, who is backing the funding of many of the slick videos that are coming out with known names that are stating very clear policies one way or the other, or highlighting a problem with one political party or another political party? And it seems to be, creating further divisions. We saw that during the Brexit campaign. It was very clear that a lot of this was there, but unfortunately, they got away with it.
Yeah, so disinformation and misinformation, that's got to be something that you guys see a lot of, Scott, with the OSINT side of your business.
Yeah, definitely. It's a critical part of any intelligence function is to look at the credibility and the accuracy of that source and the information that's coming in. We're seeing now as echo chambers in the internet space, in the deep and dark web, is really allowing Russia and other hostile state actors a platform to enable themselves to have their own agendas in an area that we've probably not seen for the last 10 to 20 years, really. And one aspect, you just got to look at the annexation of Crimea and the use of misinformation and disinformation from GRU Spetsnaz operating in the area. And all of this in this space, linking back to Russia, links into Maskarovna, so the masquerade, and actually using misinformation to enable Russia that plausible deniability aspect in any intervention, whether that's physical, cyber or technical, really.
And misinformation and disinformation is being used across the board. The little people find it a very way of having a physical effect. Misinformation is information that is false but is accidentally passed around. Disinformation is deliberately passing around misinformation for an effect. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that in other conflicts. The story that's coming out from Hamas in the Middle East, they know they can't defeat Israel militarily, but they are winning the war in the information sphere by creating the issues that there are across the West, where the West is putting increasing pressure on Israel. Vladimir Putin does that. And as Scott said, his doctrine of maskarovka, masking, is written into the Russian and the Soviet-style doctrine that's across the place. Surprise, Iran backs Hamas. Iran follows the old Soviet doctrine.
That's something that we've seen historically, going back a long time, way before even the event of the information age, but creating false flags, the ability to misattribute certain activities and create media stories in that way. But the growth of social media, the ease with which you can now put information out there, and the way algorithms within some of these systems work, that once you start down that rabbit hole, it just keeps sucking you further and further and feeds you more of the same?
Very much so. This is nothing new. The great Chinese philosopher and general from the 6th century, Sun Tzu, in the book The Art of War, and I'm paraphrasing here, turned around and said, all warfare is deception, all deception is warfare. Well, this is what we're seeing. We were good at it during the Second World War. Operation Fortitude convinced Hitler that we were going to attack Europe in the south through Greece and not through the toe of Italy, with the infamous Operation Mincemeat, where a dead body with most secret plans was floated in, knowing that those plans, or hoping those plans, would get to Hitler's desk. They did. And then creating a false army that we had said was going to attack in the Pas-de-Calais, not through Normandy, which allowed Allied success in Normandy before the Germans realized that they had to commit their Panzer Division reserves because we weren't coming into the Pas-de-Calais. So we were good at it, but that's when there was the level of state control over every information outlet. As you said, now that we've got social media, we can get stuff directly to our devices, or we can put stuff back directly to our devices. And we saw that from Donald Trump when he was president of the United States, your tweets coming out from him. And those informed not just policy, but they informed the whole reaction of a country and alliances often. And it took days to try and deal with some of the issues that were coming out. And, you know, Putin, Xi Jinping, the Grand Ayatollah, Kim Jong-un can see that. They think in multi-generational terms. So they'll do anything that they can to try and stir that pot because they know it's really easy to stir. And it causes democratic governments to focus in on what tomorrow morning's headline is going to be.
I was going to say that. They have real long-term thinking, don't they? And, you know, the ability of them to think in terms of even not just generational, but multi-generational. Whereas the West is typically bound into that 3 to 5 year election cycle. And so, you know, we've got to start, I would say, Scott, we've got to start to really start thinking much longer term. And, you know, some of the language that's being thrown around now by leaders in the West and talking about a new axis of evil that we have to combat in terms of those, you know, the Iran, Russia, China, North Korea, and their collaboration that they're doing as well.
I think it's exactly that. We're looking at the Western hegemony and the overall strategic outlets of different areas that are, you know, conflict related, stabilizing those as a country, regardless of that election cycle and that dynamic change that you get into 3 to 5 years and the policies that are being brought out. Just got to look at Sunak's recent policy on, you know, national service. You know, where is that? Where would that have and the impact that would have in relation to this? Looking at the, you know, the army reserves, the current state of the British Army is the Defence Force. You know, what is the overall strategic game for the UK, for the West in these putting into place to stabilise different regions? Russia, China, you know, Chinese Taiwan relationships. What's the US element there that not impacting by the election cycle, but actually working all together, having a core set of objectives strategically that they can then hand over to the next incoming government to continue on, and having those set again, how the mechanisms and how they're agreed would be is the real question, but it's putting them into place so that this long-term strategic planning can be put into effect and not affected by the yearly, annually, and any changes in government really.
I mean, I saw this firsthand. I was in the military when we started to pull out of Europe, and the policy at the time was that Russia was no longer a threat to the West.
Yeah, you've just got to look at language capabilities and you know, different linguistical focuses at the time, focusing in the Middle East, actually reducing the Russian capability. Now, you know, we wouldn't even dream of being in that position. And how can we assess, you know, tomorrow's conflict? And that's really where the role of intelligence comes into that, to try and see on the next conflict and that second and third order effect. Say, okay, this is what we're looking at right here, right now. But what are these connecting dots that are moving on towards? What is the overall strategic aim, operational and tactical? I think that's the element of it, which links into, you know, as Phil mentioned about the deception plan. What are we looking at on the ground? You've just got to look at footage, you know, drone activity through Ukraine on that tactical level. But actually, what is the overall strategic goal for Russia with this? And, you know, if we were doing this element back in 2014, we're looking at this aspect. See, actually, the annexation of Crimea, what a perfect demonstration on the world stage of Maskarovna. You know, the disruption in Kiev, you know, the little green men operating in this insurgency and in this, you know, asymmetric warfare was implemented extremely well. And again, you know, the distraction tactics of putting forces onto the border initially to think actually there was an invasion imminently, while at the whole time that annexation of Crimea was being taken and cemented really on the world stage. And then, you know, the troops moved away, and then now we're in a stage where obviously that has gone ahead now. So, yeah, what is the overall goal? I'm trying to get ahead of the curve for the adversary's overall strategic goal. I think that's the key role, definitely for the intelligence analysts.
Yeah, and if we look at the so what for business that's out there, you're looking at the bad state actors working in that multi-generational term. That means that what they can try and do is infiltrate our very mechanisms, our very infrastructure, very slowly over a period of time. That's why we saw the warnings over Huawei coming into our 5G. That's why we're hearing the warnings over some of the Chinese CCTV manufacturers and other Chinese technologies coming into different places. Because that is putting things in place that can be used to gather information over periods of time. All of that is below anything that would stimulate conflict. But if you're nibbling away at the intelligence gathering elephant that's out there, you're taking small nibbles at a time. You're not trying to bite big chunks out of it as you go through, as we do to react. And from a wider business perspective, what's happening with the conflicts around the world is, you know, the military are having to relook at their doctrine, change their thinking, change the way they're doing things. That's requiring the West to properly bring into the fact that the defense industrial base is part of our military infrastructure. And we have to increase our defense industrial base. We had forgotten that as a rule beforehand, but that's good for British business and good for the country, as it's good for any country which has got a defense industrial base in it, because those billions of pounds that we hear are being donated to Ukraine, they're not being sent in a big check to Ukraine for Ukraine to stick in its bank and spend on what it wants. It's actually being spent on military material and other material that's being manufactured in the UK, that's creating new jobs in the UK, that's requiring increased skill sets in companies in the UK, that's allowing people to pay more tax, that's allowing other service industries and supporting industries to be developed. So, you know, one of my passions is bacon rolls, as many people know. Investment in Ukraine from a defence perspective is allowing more bacon roll outlets to be opened around our defence industrial bases in the UK, because there are more people who want and need snacks. That can only be a good thing.
I think another area where I've seen definitely in the industry space is an increased role, and this really was born out of COVID, I think, but an increased return and focus back to business continuity, disaster recovery, and all of that piece on, you know, understanding that. And then you've just got to look at third party and supplier business continuity as well. And it's really, you know, the conflict in Ukraine, but also other geopolitical conflicts we're seeing, and the impact on that third party, that small part of that business that is critical to that UK part of UK industry, that is now, yeah, being affected by supply issues, by transport routes. You've got to look at issues with the Suez Canal, when that I forget the name of the cargo ship that actually almost went sideways down the Suez Canal, and actually that continuity there, how can you know, with the ever, you know, increasing uncertainty in geopolitical space, how can we continue to work as a business? And that business continuity aspect, understanding that critical cog in that whole aspect, is something that is definitely taken to the forefront now and very much a focus.
Some of these countries we're talking about here, these hostile nation states, are also significantly in control of supply of some of our critical imports, aren't they?
I was going to say, very much so. We saw Russia's control over European energy and the effect that had on energy prices whenever the war in Ukraine started. You know, we're looking at our just-in-time supply chain is fantastic whenever you know when you need your stuff and can predict it and the manufacturers can produce it. But when you're relying on a single supplier out of China for all of your PPE, you know, as COVID highlighted, when everyone requires a massive increase on a just-in-time contract, the capacity isn't there to produce it. And therefore, it's those that pay most will get their hands on it, like other goods. And Scott is completely right. I think one of the lessons we've learned out of COVID and will pay us back as we prepare for potential conflict is that we need to bring more manufacturing resilience and business resilience back in-house, back into the country again. That takes decades to properly do and to set up and get everything done, because you're undermining or changing a lot of the world business networks that you've got out there at the moment. But you know, the instability that's happening across the world is just reinforcing the need to do that. And it's whether we've got the political will to do it, because a lot of the time it's going to be more expensive to get goods at home. But you know, there are certain things we have to do.
I was going to say, it's not just political will, it's financial will as well, because that comes at a cost. And much of the situation we find ourselves in today is because we've outsourced to these countries because they could do it far cheaper than we could. But doesn't that then go back to what we were saying earlier about the generational view, the long-term generational view?
Yeah, and part of that is deliberate. You know, these countries have put themselves in a position where they can manufacture things cheaply. You know, China, we accuse of stealing IP. Why does China steal intellectual property? It's because whenever you look at high-tech goods, the development of them can cost millions or billions of pounds, dollars, or whatever currency you're working in. And that millions or billions of pounds and dollars has to be costed into the unit price of the high-tech goods that are then sold out onto the market once you get into manufacturing. If China can steal the design after it's finished and manufacture, it doesn't have to bring in those millions or billions into the unit mm-hmm. price of what it's selling out into the market. And that's why they can produce high-tech as good, if not possibly slightly better, technology in the functions that it can provide at a much smaller price, because it's not costing them as much to develop. Hence why they'll nick as much intellectual property as they possibly can.
And that's
yeah, and business. I think that's
go on, Scott.
So no, I think that's definitely the area. And looking at the higher education, university research, and that, trying to understand that innovation space, if you know the hostile state actors can target those for an espionage element or joint partnership and actually steal all that IP, then that's going to give them a massive competitive advantage, you know, reduce that time. So it is a massive area of concern for you know, the Western world, really, understanding and keeping those safe spaces secure for innovation, for new design technology, to not that's going to enable your potential hostile states to then use that technology against us or to improve their own infrastructure and industries.
And isn't that also a challenge with academia, that you know an awful lot of R&D actually goes on in academia, which in itself is very much open. And in fact, you know, we have in the UK deliberately driven a policy of encouraging overseas students to come to our universities. So that in itself means that that IPR is subject to disclosure if we're not careful.
And I think with all of this, it's impacting or trying to influence the culture and understand this and improving the security culture and the security understanding of people in this space. Because, you know, if people have sort of got the blinkers on, they're focused on a project and the end state, but they're not thinking about security from, you know, cyber capability, you know, the espionage element, the sabotage risk, the insider enabled risk as well. What this does, it's actually enabling hostile state actors, you know, an open door essentially to come in, take that innovation space and then go from there. But that's going to take, as Phil mentioned about business continuity, that will take years to embed and try and get people, not to that everyone's, you know, constantly looking over the shoulder, everyone's suspicious, but actually into a place where they're thinking about security, thinking about keeping the secret secret, and a lot of areas where we've got where just because technology has enabled us to share a lot more, people seem to be doing that a lot more. And actually, some areas, people have almost completely ditched protected marking and the need to know, and actually classification systems on different areas. We're sharing a lot more. Things are a lot more accessible. And should they be? In some instances, people need to think about that. And this is where your information security is massively growing. And linked into that initial point about if you understand the hostile state's intent and objective, then you can understand what are they trying to go for? What is their long-term goals that they're going to look at? So if it is technological innovation and IP, actually, how can we look as an industry, as a culture, as a security forum, to try and help people, educate them, to put the correct measures in place to keep that secure and safe, really?
Yeah, and that's one of the things we talked about on a previous podcast, is the difference between protection of intellectual property rights and the need to combine that with really good information security. Because if the information security lets you down, and we've already said there, you know, China is incredibly adept at scooping up IPR and not caring about the fact that something is already patented in order to get their product into the market. We need to focus on both protecting the rights, but also protecting the information itself.
Well, and it's not just down to you know, stuff that's in protectively marked areas and everything else. And I think, Scott, your education is the biggest word that you use there, because it's getting the awareness out there. What the Chinese tend to do is they hoover everything up. You know, they will get so much that's out there, and then they will take our improving AI capabilities and now generative AI capabilities to analyze massive volumes of data. And there's The Chinese are developing quantum computing capability faster than anyone else. Why are they doing that? Because they need that quantum computing to analyze the vast bits of data. And building the intelligence picture is like building the picture on your television screen, but your television screen is the biggest TV screen that you can get at the biggest resolution, and you're building it one pixel at a time. In fact, you're building it, each pixel is made up of three primary colors. You're building it each color in each pixel at a time. And therefore, every tiny little snippet that you can get and you can pull together and you can analyze will help you build that picture a little bit more. The majority of it is not going to come from areas that you've already protectively marked and it's in there, because a lot of that stuff will be discussed in a tiny little conversation out here that, oh, I didn't give any secrets away. I only mentioned that little bit. And then that little bit's over there and that little bit's over there. Well, if you've got AI that can bring all those little bits together, you can build up that full picture. And that's why the Chinese hoover absolutely everything. So if people think that they're not going to be targeted, I'm sorry. The majority of us are being targeted. And then on top of that, just with the data hoovering, you've got the traditional old espionage methods, and people will be targeted through there. I lecture in a number of different security conferences. I always ask when I'm doing that, how many people think that they're a potential target of a nation state? And in an audience of about 100, I'll get, you know, half a dozen hands will go in the air. And when the reality is, it's every single person that's sitting in that audience is a potential target for hostile nation states. And people need to realize that.
And we've seen a huge increase in activity in arenas like LinkedIn, haven't we, where individuals are being approached and groomed and coerced and in some cases offered financial inducements. I was actually at the Imperial War Museum a couple of months ago in London, and they had a fantastic limited time exhibition on intelligence and espionage, which was absolutely fascinating. And of course, you know, much of what we're talking about there, loose lips sink ships, is as relevant today as it was back then.
Oh, more so, because the people who got access in through social media. Sorry, Scott.
Yeah, no, I think and that links into the National Protective Security Authority's NPSA's Think Before You Link. Getting people to think about that step in LinkedIn, and you know, how many mutual friends do they have, and not having that as being a rule or a yardstick to gauge if somebody's credible. Is it the person that you're after? They might be asking about one part of the job, but actually that's two steps removed from what they're really trying to obtain and everything with that. But yeah, I was at a Security Institute event recently, and the government was there talking about their a function paper that they did. And they said there's four spaces that we're trying to protect here, really, is the human space, the physical, the cyber and the technological space. And actually getting people to do basic things like think before you link on LinkedIn, but also making sure that they're not taking their phones into secure locations. They're not passing on information on there, that when they take a photo for their LinkedIn profile, you know, they're thinking about the background and everything out there. What is, like Phil was saying, what else is being leaked online that, you know, the hostile state actors are just constantly hoovering up and saying, okay, my person of interest is individual X, but actually through the network that they're working on and actually the wider backgrounds, they could piece a lot more together, and people just being, you know, educated in that space, thinking about it. And then also if they're in an industry working at a location that potentially could be a desirable target for hostile state actors, thinking about critical national infrastructure. We saw an article recently about, you know, the waterwork power grids potentially being a target for that prelude and for state actors to try and target. But from a cyber point of view, you know, well, who are these people that potentially working at this location that could be leaking secrets, you know, and everything with that, really? And it all ties into that, yeah.
And you have to remember, with the growth in cyber threat, businesses have stopped thinking so much around the human and physical threat that we're talking about here as well.
Well, yeah, and yeah, you have to remember that it's not just the picture that you're taking that's out there. It's the metadata that's sitting behind the picture, and it's the apps that you're using to take the picture. You look at a lot of the apps that are out there. You know, again, whenever I talk about Pokemon Go, and Pokemon Go as a viral game that came out, had you taking pictures in the real world that had superimposed monsters over them in the servers. All that data was held in one server in one continent that one nation had access to. What a good way of getting, you know, intelligence data on particular areas, especially if you then, in ticking the terms and conditions, give access to everything that was on the device that you're taking the pictures with and playing the game on. And if you ask the same question about TikTok, you know, is TikTok there a viral video sharing platform? Yes, it is. Is it a good video sharing platform? Yes, it is. Does it have another role? Yes, it has. And that other role is as a part of this massive intelligence gathering scheme that the Chinese government's got out there, and are they hoovering everything up, and are they hoovering all the metadata that's behind it and everything else, and situating the appreciation through all of that? Of course they're doing it. And you know, have you ticked the terms and conditions to say that you've read what they can access on your device? I've read the terms and conditions. I suspect not many listeners out there will have done that. The terms and conditions are so bland. You've mm-hmm. given them permission to do anything they want on your device. And that's not then bringing in the formularies of spyware that you're going to get in different places that mm-hmm. the Russians are putting in from a national perspective. The Chinese are fantastic at. The Iranians have got. And, of course, Kim Jong-un, as a plausibly deniable little bad boy working on behalf of Russia and China, will have access to it as well. Not saying that we don't have it and we're not putting it onto their devices if we can. But, hey, that's a different story.
I had a similar conversation with my family around a very cheap Chinese shopping website. And, you know, why do you think things are so cheap? And what do you think they're actually taking off you other than just a couple of quid here for a pair of trainers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all data and it's all your connections.
One of the things that occurs to me whenever I consider, should I use a platform? Should I use an app? How much is it going to cost me? I'm much more likely to use something that I pay for and that I've chosen than something that tells me it's free or it's incredibly cheap. Because as I've always said, after a lifetime of working in information, is that if it's free, then you are the product.
Absolutely.
100%. Yeah. 100%. And Putin's exploiting that, and Putin is exploiting that in his conflict with Russia, and Putin is exploiting that in the way that other conflicts around the world are working. You know, who is gaining most out of what's going on in the Middle East at the moment? Well, it's Vladimir Putin. He's come off the headlines. He's not front page headlines and everything, and it's not being discussed on a daily basis in our capital cities because everyone is focused on Israel, Hamas, and the political implications of what's going on there.
And do you think businesses spend enough time actually doing quality threat assessments and gathering intelligence to inform those threat assessments and understanding hostile threat actors and their MO and their motivation and their capability? Are businesses putting enough effort into that?
I think some are. That would be a disservice to those that are spending the time. But then some people, it's like a lot of things in security. It can be the first thing to go when other things, other operational requirements become on board, or there's a different focus for the business, really, where actually having that good baseline for security, having a consistent, alert, vigilant security culture that is well educated, but then also that's not just the end state. It's continuously reviewing that security culture, making sure the security provisions are correct, making sure the security measures to keep everything secure, all your people, your assets, all your information, all your IP secure, is key in that. And that's where that intelligence piece comes into, for that monitoring, continuous monitoring, continually looking at that, you know, the horizon scanning, which is, you know, the bread and butter for that intelligence analyst to say, okay, this is what's currently happening, and anyone can report the news. But actually, what's happening tomorrow? What's next? What's your short term? What's your medium? What's your long term? You know, sort of assessments that will actually enable you to understand that. You know, a company might not be a threat now. However, that doesn't mean they're not potentially be an attractive target in 12 months. dependent on the objectives of that hostile state actor. So it's key, and it can be a step that is taken. You know, they think, okay, we've contained this now, we've got understand the intelligence picture. But as Phil said, it's constantly evolving. You know, you're constantly building up these little sort of avenues of inquiry, building up that intelligence picture, and that landscape can change rapidly just by one bit of intelligence coming in and mark requirement, a complete reassessment of what people understood, what you thought the enemy's sort of priorities were, and actually looking at your security vulnerabilities as well, whether you're doing that physical penetration testing as well as the cyber penetration testing. Not neglecting an area as well is key, because MOs might change. You know, the article about the threat to physical attacks, or actually, you know, are we putting too much emphasis on cyber? Should we be balancing it between physical and the cyberspace now? That continuous review needs to be in play to look at that, look at the threats. Am I protecting what I need to protect? What are my biggest priorities, but also what are the enemies and the adversaries' biggest priorities as well?
We've talked at length over the last decade about converged threat, but if we look at, you know, the UK response to both national security and business security, we still very much have physical and cyber in separate silos.
Yeah.
We have different agencies that look after physical security and physical threat to cyber threat. And at a national level, both of those agencies produce 5-year strategies. And that drips down into business. So most businesses are only ever thinking in terms of 3- and 5-year strategies. Yeah. And there isn't that long-termism coming out of any of it from the top to individuals.
And I think this is going to take a different way of businesses thinking. And I think people need to look at the risks to their business. Now, when you look at a risk to a business, you know, as I said, I was a military planner for many years. You've got your vital ground and you've got your key terrain. In military planning terms, your vital ground is that area that if you lose it, you've lost everything. So what's that in your business? Can a CEO, can a board define what their vital ground is? Because that is where, from a business perspective, your greatest risk is. And that's where you need to provide most protection. And your key terrain is that terrain that will influence your vital ground. So your next layer of protection and surveillance and intelligence monitoring should be on that. And then you've got all the stuff that's going on outside, because you can't do everything with the limited resources out of there. But then it's whenever you're looking at those risks, it's looking at not just things from a classic perspective, because Mike, you're 100% right. We still silo ourselves into that cyber and that's physical. Well, where would the information risk then fit in a company? What happens if we get a Gerald Ratner moment where your CEO, it goes out on your Twitter brackets X feed, I'll still call it Twitter. Your CEO goes out with a statement saying that the services that we provide are terrible. And by the way, we've had 15 cyber attacks and all your data has been leaked, but we're not telling you, and puts that out as a video. That's a virally created or AI or generative AI created video that you know nothing about. Your adversaries have put it out to have an effect. What's that going to have an effect on your share price, your customer confidence, or anything else? What's your plan for identifying that? And this is where the intelligence side, the monitoring is critical, as Scott put in. What's your plan for getting it down? And what are your contingency plans for dealing with it? It doesn't fit into cyber. It doesn't fit into physical. It is a security threat. And it is probably a bigger risk than anything else that's out there in business terms. And I suspect most businesses that are listening into this don't have a plan for that. And most will not have thought about that sort of thing happening. It could happen tomorrow. It would take me about 10 minutes to put together a video like that and researching who your CEO is, setting up a Twitter account and getting that out onto a viral area and putting it out onto TikTok, because I'll know what all the hashtags are that I need to put in. By the time you try and close that down, it will be 24 hours, 48 hours worth of it doing damage.
In many ways, it stops being a security problem and becomes a Marcom's nightmare, doesn't it?
Well, it's not Marcom's nightmare. It's a business nightmare. And this is where, actually, from a security perspective, if you look at it from a risk management and perspective, it's actually a board's issue. It's not a Marcom issue. It's not a security issue. It's not an IT issue. It's not a cyber issue. And we tie that into what's going on at the moment with the elections and misinformation and disinformation. What if one of your senior executives retweets or reposts something that is from a misinformation perspective, but it's been put out by someone as disinformation, and your competitors pick up on that and go, oh, Jane Smith has done that, therefore this company must be doing this. What's your policy to deal with that? Is that responsibility of Marcoms, or is that responsibility of a board to take ownership of these sorts of things? And I think the threat that there is at the moment, and the threat in businesses, we need to recognise that this is a board level, this is a CEO level, this is a managing director level area that they need to start to take responsibility for, not pass to the IT department.
I think that's one of the key bits, and everything we're seeing in this space is actually that senior management level buy-in. I think once you've got that investment at senior level with these companies, that then is an enabler then, because that then makes the company's priority then becomes the whole aspect of the security and dealing with that. And then the next bit is educating the senior membership, the senior leadership in companies to actually, what is business continuity? What is incident management? And what is disaster recovery? And actually, because a lot of times people blur the two between business continuity and incident management, and having separate silos, different functions and needs within the business to get them through an incident, actually to keep the business continuity plan going and alive with the monitoring and the intelligence and the risk picture being laid over the top with that, that's when you can start to really, for the company, building that resilience overall with that. And I think one bit is, which is key, and it was at that at the meeting with the government, is I mentioned the four spaces, the human, the physical, the cyber and the technical, but actually it's the convergence of two, where you got that one employee that leaves the back door to the office location open so they can have a cigarette break. It's that interaction that's where you get the vulnerabilities being embedded. And actually, by preventing us to seeing them in every silo, you've got to have something that we've worked on, is a convergent intelligence services model. Or actually, you look at what you're trying to protect. So if you're trying to protect the people, what are all the services and elements within that that can help you protect that person? And then you take the physical. So you actually try and flip it on its head. With the risk being obviously ever present, and you're looking at that attack vector and you're trying to protect against that, but you actually focus on the entity that you're trying to protect and the services that could be wrapped around that to protect the entity or the information, the IP or whatever it is. Than just trying to protect in isolation and saying, okay, we've got this policy to target the risk, actually focus it and change it to look at what you're trying to protect.
So that word converge keeps on coming up, doesn't it? It comes up time again. And it's so important that I think that both at a government level and at a business level that we really get our arms around what converge looks like and start dealing with things in a much more holistic manner.
So holistic, that's another term. People seem to use that quite a lot. But what actually, if you drill that down, what does that mean? And probably a great mapping exercise is for business to say, look at everything, look at the whole business in its entity, and then take, business continuity. Have we got that fully mapped out? Incident management, map that out completely. Because people say, we're taking a holistic approach to security. But what does that actually mean? And I think when you unpack that, that really could be an excellent exercise for industries and for companies to do.
It really is, Scott. I was at an event last year and had a conversation with someone near a stand, and I was talking about, holistic security, and they said, we do holistic security. And I was delighted to learn that holistic security is actually fences and gates.
Okay, yeah.
So I walked away thinking, I've been doing it wrong for 13 years. My mum didn't tell me this.
That's part of the problem. Security is not being a profession, because there isn't a professional body overseeing it. And the membership organisations do a fantastic job, but they're not a professional body, because we don't have an agreed set of definitions that everyone works to. And therefore an agreed doctrine that we can work to. But the other thing that comes in is It's trying to see security as this business enabler. And we've talked about this beforehand, and it has to be seen as a business enabler. And Mike, you mentioned Marcoms. You know, how many companies out there are turning around saying, hey, we provide this level of security, and this is what we do to make sure that your data, which is our center of gravity, our vital ground is being protected in this way. And therefore you should come to us because we're looking after all of that much better than all of our rivals are doing. Why are we not using the security elements and the effort that's been put in and the money that's being spent on securing everything for your customers as a marketing positive? We don't see that. It should be.
Do you think that's because in a lot of businesses, Marcoms isn't seen as part of the security team?
Well, Marcom isn't seen as part of the security team in the same way that HR isn't seen often as part of the security team. Whereas, whenever I turn around to people and say, look, in the past, I have got people in organizations to get me stuff out of those organizations where there are so many layers of physical and IT security that they should have been identified immediately, but they haven't, because I've hacked the human, human with access. And that will be happening in businesses as well as it's happening in dealing with different nefarious organizations or nation states or anything else. That's good old-fashioned espionage, the second oldest. It's part of the second oldest profession. It is going on. And therefore, if you think you're protected because you've got the latest widget protecting your network, think again, folks.
So we hear the term industrial espionage, and I've had this conversation with people, and they sort of say, "Oh, this is the domain of spy films and James Bond." But industrial espionage is a very real thing, in the same way that state espionage is.
Yeah, no, it's a massive industry, really, and again, linking into that innovation space, really, and keeping the client's secret. What is being said in behind closed doors, and that's not only at a tactical, so maybe an employee level, maybe there's HR meetings that are being listened into and whatever from that point of view, but also more serious things where your trade secrets, inside knowledge is being leaked and being specifically targeted by competitors, other nefarious individuals that are trying to take that information away and listen into the secret to sensitive areas, really.
I'll give you a very real example. The Oxford University AstraZeneca development of the vaccine during COVID. The Russians put a very active campaign in to try and steal the intellectual property behind that, because what they wanted to do was take the vaccine and produce it themselves and get it onto the market. First of all, to get an information coup, so that they could say that they developed it ahead of anyone else. It was initial approaches were coming through cyberspace, but there were physical approaches as well, both hitting in Oxford University through the research elements that are there, but in through AstraZeneca, in through the company networks that are there. Luckily, it had been identified by NCSC and other UK national organisations who put a team together that sat down with the heads of security for each of those organizations and came up with a constant plan to mitigate against the threat and to monitor where it was coming in from different angles. But it took an awful lot of effort from a lot of different agencies to come together to stop that business being interrupted by a nation state who wanted to steal it.
And at a national level, we saw this recently, didn't we, in Poland, where they had rescheduled the meeting to be somewhere where they normally didn't have it, a cabinet meeting, only to discover a number of listening devices. But we can boil that down at a business level as well, because many people forget that devices we've started to take for granted, like mobile phones, are in themselves very much listening devices as well. And, Scott, you guys, through the work of the Esoteric, you do that sort of technical countermeasure side of things, but it's something that is often, in my opinion, when I look at security risk assessments, is often very rarely considered.
It's a critical area, ensuring that the environment in which businesses are operating are secure. When was the last time people had their offices swept for eavesdropping? That technical counter surveillance measures can be missed, and it's actually a critical area that secret board members, board areas that could be leaking that information. But also, we look at situational awareness training for individuals, because even the companies that that do have TCSM, you know, the sweeps and everything in that space, you know, then if their employee goes down the pub, goes down on social media, starts putting photos, actually they might be operating in a really secure environment, but actually the individual then is creating their own vulnerabilities and leaking things, and or that then the staff members. So it's then providing that situational awareness and security awareness training to staff members to actually improve their vigilance, so that actually it's not just, you know, the weak link in the chain is not the individual in that space, even though they're actually operating in a secure space.
Business leaders, often exempted from training, often, you know, in receipt and in possession of some of the most sensitive information, and they tend to be let off the hook with a lot of things. Yeah, you can use your own phone, your own laptop, your own. Yeah, you can. No, you don't have to do data protection training. No, you don't have to do. And business leaders are like a leaky bucket.
I've had senior executives drop out of security training that I've been running at the last minute because something more important has come up.
I was just looking for a book on Pegasus. And Pegasus, for those that don't know, produced by the Israeli company NSO, is a bit of spyware that has been found. It was found on Boris Johnson and most of his cabinet's phones. It was found on most of the phones of the leaders of the opposition. That's in there. That bit of spyware we know about, and we've got methods of checking for it and all the rest of it. But you know, an esoteric sweep is not going to find that if you've got it on your mobile device, whether it be a phone or whether it be a tablet sitting in a meeting. It can turn the camera on, it can turn the microphone on, even if you've got the device switched off and you don't know about it. Your device turns into one of the best listening devices possible. So everyone's carrying a listening device. Now, we know about Pegasus. We know about NSO. We don't know what different nation states are doing. We don't know what's embedded in all those different apps that we're downloading. So your lovely transcription app that will take the minutes of the meeting automatically for you as you're putting it in there, putting that out. Where's that app come from? Where's that data being stored? Where's it being put out? The other thing is, if I've hacked the individual and I'm looking at and I'm typing on the screen, looking at the board meeting minutes that we're preparing to go out to shareholders for our sale that we haven't told anyone about because it'll affect share price and all the rest of it. Where's that camera pointing at and who's that transmitting to? And you know, if that person's got access, your network sniffing's not going to find out. Your CCTV cameras in offices and bits and pieces almost certainly won't be able to identify because the person will have put their desk position in a way that they can't be surveilled by CCTV. Yet, what's your mobile phone policy when it comes to that? Your personal mobile phone policy as well as business one.
And isn't that a growing threat area with hybrid working, with both business and personal devices within listening distance of sensitive business conversations? You could be sat in the kitchen having a sensitive business meeting and have a smart hub running in the background. We're working across home Wi-Fi and wireless access points and connection to the internet that don't have traditional internet security capabilities on them the way that a business network would have. Hybrid working has really changed, you know, our security model almost on its head. And with the digital backgrounds that you can have as well, often you might not even know where somebody sat when they're having that meeting. It could just as easily be in a pub or a cafe.
Well, or you don't know what has been steganographically embedded into the digital background that you're putting on the meeting that has tripped a piece of spyware that is recording everything that's going on. You know, that capability is out there.
Steganographically. Now, that's got to be the word for today.
That is a good word. I love steganography, but it is a real threat. Google it, people, if you're listening in. It's worth a Google, it's worth a read, and it will scare you to bits.
So top tips then, both for businesses and people, to keep themselves safe in this new world order. What would you say to businesses first?
I think with both, actually, it's that education piece. You know, you want to be in a place where you're not there to frighten people. You're not going to be talking about the most dangerous course of action all the time. But you actually want to talk about, you know, what is the risk landscape doing? What is the intelligence picture to the business? And what are you trying to protect? What are the risks that are currently facing? And if you educate your staff and try and start on that journey to create a culture a vigilant security culture that are, you know, turning the phones off, not having the devices close to the laptops, thinking about what software they're downloading. You can really then start to improve and build a really good foundation to have a really effective security culture going forward, regardless of the risk. And then the other part is understanding the risk landscape and the rapidly changing risk landscape, understanding the geopolitical aspect of that. And then with that, understanding your business from the business continuity front, your incident management and your disaster recovery aspect. And what are your dependencies throughout all of that? And, you know, is, you know, a conflict occurring in Ukraine and Russia having an impact on that, I suppose? Well, do you have a plan for that? And what is your contingency planning for that? That would be two things for me that I thought.
And culture, you know, culture comes from the top, doesn't it? So we have to have that executive involvement right from the beginning and all the way through.
Definitely.
I agree with everything that Scott said, and I'd add that your businesses need to recognize that security, protecting your vital ground, because that's what security is there for, is the responsibility of the head of the business and should be seen as a business enabler, not an activity that just has to be done. And if you can get that mindset and that culture in, it'll allow you to properly understand the risks to your business and then take the risks that are coming from outside and see how those can impact on your business and get, first and foremost, the mitigation techniques in place and processes in place. And most of them are just going back to basics and doing the basics right. And that will cover 80 to 90% of what the threat is. But also then understanding that if something does get through, or more probably when something does get through, what are your business continuity plans to deal with that when it happens? If you've got that, you're sorted. If you haven't got that, then you're at risk.
And for me, it's understanding where your valuable assets are, truly understanding your assets and how important they are and how to protect them. And, you know, if there's a lesson to be learned from the British Museum, it's exactly that. Know what's important to you and also never lose sight of the insider threat. So thinking about sort of the, you know, political interference and geopolitical issues, and disinformation and misinformation, you know, great differentiation that you gave us there, Phil, between the two. But, you know, many of us now, we consume our news and we consume, in some ways, our views are informed by what we're consuming online. But, you know, and I mentioned, you know, that ability sometimes to end up going down a rabbit hole, because the more you consume of a particular nature, the more the algorithms suck you in. There is that sort of almost the ability to have self-confirmed bias, isn't there?
Well, and it's not just the algorithms. You tend to suck yourself into a lot of these things. You know, you get an argument that you put out on, I'll use Twitter as the example, put on Twitter, and, you know, 20% of the people agree with you completely, and then you get the trolls come in and start disagreeing with you and all the rest of it. You block all the trolls, and then you put another statement out with a similar argument, and 40% of your followers agree with you, but you've still got 60% trolls. So you block the trolls that are coming in, and eventually you get to a point where you've got 90% of those are agreeing with you, and you think, yes, that's my argument is, it's great, it must be right, everyone's agreeing with me. Well, actually, you've blocked all the alternatives that are out there in many cases, because some of them come in a nasty way. But that's just what I call self-misinforming groupthink. You've done it to yourself. You've created your own echo chamber. Now, those that want to influence us recognize that, and they can influence the algorithms that they can control those, but they can influence what's been put in to create that bias, because they will understand what's going on. An example of that, you know, people think that they can't be manipulated in any way, shape or form. For those of us of a certain age, if I turn around and say, hands that do dishes, people will be thinking automatically of, you know, fairy liquid. If I play Dvorak's New World Symphony, people would be thinking of a little boy pushing a bicycle up a steep hill with a loaf of bread, or a Hamlet cigar being struck up and you'd be doing that. That's marketing. Now, there's been some research into manipulative marketing, which is turning around and taking misinformation and using that to push stuff out, and the way that can influence. You know, if the open marketing can make people think, and, you know, looking at you know, all of you there, you smiled. That's a physical reaction, but that physical reaction is caused by the change of chemical balances within your head. Your chemical balances within your head through your serotonin, dopamine, and other feel-good chemicals will decide what your mood is and decide whether you're going to block something or accept something or anything else. You take a big data analysis of individuals, as happened with Cambridge Analytica during the last election 2017, and you then apply manipulative marketing techniques, and then you provide targeted messages going through social media. You've identified where people are sitting on a fence politically or socially or something else. You then reinforce it one way or the other to push them off the fence, whether that be directly, whether that be through their first level contacts or their second level contacts, which happen to be family, friends, and everything else. And you can change the way people think. That can undermine our democratic principles, because you can influence the way people vote. And if people think that that's not happening, it blew up in 2017. We're many years ahead of that now in capability. It is being used today to influence what's going on. And if you think you can't be manipulated, hands that do dishes. It makes you smile.
Well, and we're all probably guilty to some extent or another, depending on how how jaded and paranoid we are. And, you know, certainly I've been guilty myself in the past of thinking, well, I'm smarter than that. I can't be manipulated like that. I do my own research. But where is the information that I'm researching coming from?
I think that's the key bit, and definitely with the intelligence analyst and the people that are working with, is understanding those biases, understanding what those trip hazards, and working through a series of structured analytical techniques to try and design that out. So they've got the analyst is there that's completely neutral, completely, you know, when they're doing the research, it's systematic. It's not being sort of driven down rabbit holes that are being steered for them by the algorithms and everything with that. And actually using those structured analytical techniques and, you know, analysis of competing hypotheses, all this great stuff that people have been trained to actually say, okay, I think A, but I'm going to have a hypothesis B to counter that, and I'm going to throw in an outlier as hypothesis C to try and work through those, so that you're looking definitely at the time of the election, what is misinformation, what is out there in that space on different parties, different agendas and rhetorics, but also what is that disinformation and where is that coming from? And looking at the source, looking at the credibility of the information itself that's been passed on, and actually corroborating that with other sources and different areas. But like you were saying, Phil, if you all corroborate with each other and you've got all the same sources, actually, then that becomes, you know, that self-licking lollipop, essentially, that you can then generate your own thing. Actually, say, yeah, it's all fine. Look, I've done this assessment. It's now gone from realistic possibility to now highly likely, because all these sources are the same thing. Yeah, but you pulled those sources together. So dropping that in, being systematic, thinking about the source credibility and also the collection of those as well, and not just in open space but also in other academic circles, you know, industrial circles, whatever that be, trying to have a range of individuals with viewpoints to try and design out that those biases is key, and something that we are, well, it's critical, isn't it? For any intelligence function, you have to have that, because it can be lethal.
I was going to say, this is where, you know, from a board perspective, diversity is critical. Diversity in thinking. You know, if you're sitting around the boardroom and all your management are white, male, grey-haired, 50s to 60s, then the chances are everyone is going to be thinking in a similar way, and you're more open to groupthink and groupthink bias. Whereas if you've got a diverse board that's sitting there, and people are thinking of things from different perspectives, you're likely to get a more enjoyable argument and discussion about what's going on, but you're going to see things from different perspectives. So it's going to be less easy for you as a business to be influenced in different ways. That's where diversity is critical to business.
You pretty much just described the boards of most of the industry associations that represent the security profession there, Phil.
Yeah, I know, and this is a big part of the problem as well. And you know, I as you know, put a lot of conferences together. The difficulty I have in getting a diverse speaking audience is shocking. And I put a lot of effort into it because it's the only way that we get away from that groupthink.
And also that means being prepared to pull in and assess and be open to information from many different sources. Yeah. It puts me in mind of, in my very early leadership days, we were set a task. We were given a news story and then had to go off and look at how all the various tabloids and broadsheets reported the same story. And it actually opened my eyes significantly to just how differently the same set of facts could be spun depending on the the political leaning of that particular newspaper and how it wanted to approach it and the point it wanted to make. And that situation has just exponentially increased now, hasn't it, with the various sources that we can consume, combined with, as we've been saying there, you know, the ability to be have bias self-confirmed, the algorithms to drag us into that whirlhole, the ability to find ourselves only speaking to people who confirm what we already think. So our boards need to be open to multiple sources and have that open-mindedness that comes from diversity.
Yeah, and I think we need to recognise that as human beings, we've got an inherent bias. You know, if we've got two teams, the Reds and the Blues, if you're a Red supporter, you will always have a bias towards whatever the opinion is for the Reds. If you're a Blues supporter, you'll always disagree with what the Reds are saying and have a bias towards what the Blues are saying, even if it may be completely logical and completely right. And this is where, from a political perspective, and we have to be really careful in business that we don't fall into this trap, but a fear that we are. From a political perspective, if we examine what our politicians are doing from all sides, we've got politics by soundbite now. And that soundbite does not give the full story. It's spun, and therefore it is disinformation. So we've got politics by disinformation to have you on either the red side or the blue side or whatever side that's in there. And we're not getting the reality. And it's very difficult to drill down and get that reality because you'll have a bias as to, as you said, Mike, which newspaper you'll read the reality in. And that will have that its own spin on it. And therefore, from a... You know, Scott, in your department, I suspect the real difficulty is getting those neutral individuals in a way that you can try and get rid of those biases out whenever you're analysing things. And that's why it's so critical to get professional organisations to look at your intelligence aspects and give you that reality. And 9 times out of 10, that reality may not be what you want to hear, but you have to recognise it.
And yeah, giving their assessments based on, you know, on all the valuable accurate information as well. Otherwise, if you've got disinformation and then you put assessments on the top of that, you're working on bad information and then bad intelligence from the get-go. So yeah, having that place where the analysts are in a place following that structured analytical techniques and not just resting on the laurels as well, and continuously working through different areas and different techniques that they can design that out, and it is key. It's key with all of that.
So, I mean, is it possible, do you think, certainly in Western thinking, to get out of that cycle? I'm thinking, we've been working with both the MOD and government, both of which have published a new assurance methodology called Secure by Design, the idea being that we get away from that 1 year, 3 year, even 5 year assurance cycle, and security is done as a continuous assurance activity. Is it possible for us, both at a national level and a business level, to do that 360-degree turn and reassess how we think about assurance and make it something that we do as a continuous, agile, iterative approach rather than thinking in 3 and 5 year business cycles?
I think one point of this is the risk management within the business and having that in a... If you take any form, ISO 31000, the risk management approach, they've got the monitoring aspect factored within that. And if you're doing not only the monitoring aspect for new risks and emerging vulnerabilities within the company, but you're also then looking and monitoring the effectiveness of the risk management approach and constantly evolving that, then actually, as long as you're doing that continuously, it doesn't matter, 1, 3, 5, 8, 10, you're constantly building in an effective framework to react accordingly to the current intelligence picture, and also the risk landscape for the business. And then that way you're constantly evolving it and designing that in from the start. And then with the wider aspects, you can layer them into the top, but they won't have so much of a dependency and control over the overall strategy. If you're looking at internal dependencies and external dependencies.
Yeah, that's fine if we're doing it as a continuous activity, but we all know that many businesses are stuck in this mentality of we do an annual penetration test, whether that's physical or IT penetration testing. We revisit our risk assessment, if we're lucky, quarterly, but realistically, probably annually. And, you know, even at a government level, the idea of security accreditation was something that we did in 1 or 3 year cycles. So I think, you know, there are businesses and organizations out there who think they're doing it as a continuous assurance, but actually, and you know, maybe this is in itself a form of bias, what they're really doing is an annual or biannual assessment.
I think businesses ask the first question, do I have to do it? Yes, yeah. No. And if it's yes, what do I have to do? So let's assume it's yes. What do I have to do? I have to do something that complies with either a law or a regulation, and bits and pieces. Now, our legislation and our regulatory environment is reactive. It's not proactive. I'll put on the table the Computer Misuse Act in 1990 as a classic. You know, I think the IT world and computers and how data is handled and the threat that's out there has changed a little bit since 1990. So our do I have to do it, therefore, in case I get nicked, is something that is way out of date. And therefore, what businesses aren't doing, which is where I think they're making a big mistake, is being proactive and actually looking at what best practice is that's out there in a way to utilize managing that risk, mitigating the risk, and preparing the business continuity from a business positive perspective. And the minimum standard should be what they are required to do. But it's then taking that and applying what the actual risk is and how that's likely to develop over the next 3 to 5 years. I think there are very few businesses doing that. And we look at what's going on with Martin's Law and the physical security side of things at the moment. And businesses are waiting till the legislation comes in to tell them what to do before they're doing things. They're thinking about it, yes. They're not going to spend any money. They're not going to do anything. Whereas at the moment, if businesses did do and went for a standard above that, but based on practical intelligence-based threat assessments and all the rest of it, then they would be ahead of the game. And they could use that from a Marcom perspective to say, we recognize this is coming. We're going to be ahead of the game. We're better than any of our competitors that are out there. But people aren't doing it. And this is where I would almost suggest that we need to, as an industry, change. And our heads of security, our chief security officers, and all the rest of it should now not necessarily be security professionals, but they should be business professionals. Because you rely on the security professionals for your advice, but you have to translate that into business speak to make sure that businesses can understand the benefits and you use everything from a business positive perspective. I think we're a long way off that yet.
And therein is a whole other discussion, isn't there, about should security people be in charge of the business? That's a discussion for another day, maybe. Sorry, Scott, I spoke.
No, I think that helping with having business professionals would help with that convergence as well, because they would understand the whole aspect of the business and not be siloed into that space that is their specialism. And having a look at understanding how HR links into recruitment, which is the marketing, which is the whole aspect of it, could not only help them, and then if they're empowered by intelligence and risk management and everything that comes with that, they can then understand the convergence of the business world, but also the convergence of the risk world as well. And that would then hopefully build out that really strong culture and education piece that we've mentioned earlier.
And maybe then we'd finally get to the panacea of having security risk as a business risk.
Ah, that would be good.
Well, I think there's certainly been some interesting discussion there, and certainly some food for thought. I think even as a lifelong security professional, I'm walking away from this particular podcast thinking about my personal behaviours and how that impacts on my professional life as well. So something for all of us to think about, from government down to the individual. Thank you very much, guys. I've been joined today by Phil Ingram. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
And by Scott Wesley. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Thank you.
And this has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. If you liked this, reach out and tell us. If you didn't, reach out and tell us. And if there's something you'd really like us to talk about in future podcasts, definitely reach out and tell us, because we're open to all opinions and not subject to groupthink. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'll see you on the next one.